Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Tonight on this recorded edition of Extension 720, a very significant American writer who writes about people without whom the world would have been different or would have developed more slowly. Dava Sobel is my guest. She's written earlier about the discovery of longitude. She's written earlier about Galileo, and more particularly about Galileo as seen through the letters by his daughter. And now we deal with, I don't know whether we call Copernicus a German or a Pole. What do you think?
That's controversial.
Yeah.
He lived in a part of Poland that was German.
Yeah.
So his language would have been German. But the Poles claim him.
As indeed they should.
Yes.
Everybody should claim him, though the church of which he was an official was a canon of a major bishopric. The church certainly was very displeased with him for quite some time.
Yes, but not until well after his death. He actually dedicated his great book on the revolutions of the heavenly spheres to the reigning pope of his time, Paul III. And because he wrote the book in Latin and it was densely mathematical, it was clearly aimed at an expert audience. And so it didn't draw fire for quite some time. It was really Galileo who got Copernicus in trouble with the church.
I'm looking for the title of the book, De Revolutionibus. How does it go?
De Revolutionibus Orbem Celestium.
There we are. On the revolution of the celestial spheres.
Yes.
To state it simply, too simply, in fact, he was the man who persuaded ultimately all the rest of the world that Ptolemy's cosmology was wrong, that this was not a heliocentric world or heliocentric portion of the universe, but rather,
heliocentric. Right.
It was not, what's the term for earthocentric?
Geocentric.
Geocentric, of course. And that was the Ptolemaic view, that everything revolved around the earth. The earth was the one stable station in reality.
Yes.
And there's even biblical authority for that.
Indeed.
As well as
common sense.
Yeah.
Because it certainly doesn't feel as though it's moving.
It does not feel as though it's moving. But how did Copernicus didn't have a lot of telescopes. He didn't have
any telescope observatory.
How did he come to understand that the sun is the, quote, stationary place? Of course, it's not really stationary either, as we now know.
But
stationary to our solar system.
Yes. He never tells how he figured it out. But he was using mathematics and logic and intuition and realizing that it makes much more sense to move the Earth than to have all of the stars and planets and sun going around this tiny little world.
Do you mean it's still a mystery as to how he thought that through?
That's right. He never explains why he did it. It's one of the mysteries of the universe.
Well, one very important thing that I learned from this book is that, and I loved reading this book.
Thank you.
And the play interior to it. This is both a biography and, in the middle of the biography, a play that you've written.
Yes.
About the same materials. And one thing I learned was that he was, as I suppose were most of the advanced intellects of his time, half an astrologer as well as, in this case, an astronomer.
Yes, at that time, astrology and astronomy were really joined sciences. Yeah. But even then, there were astrological abuses. Some people using astrology to make unimportant predictions, while the serious astrologers felt that you looked at the grand march of history, the rise of religious prophets and the fall of empires, not the minutia of people's daily lives. However, there were many astrologers making a good living predicting the minutia of people's daily lives.
I can't resist asking you, what's your sign?
Do you want to guess?
Aries.
Gemini.
Gemini. And have you looked at your horoscope for the day?
Oh, not in the newspaper. No, but I have had my horoscope cast, and I had Copernicus's horoscope interpreted by an astrologer, which turned out to be extremely interesting because in a new horoscope, there is one from his day, but if you add in the planets that have been discovered since his time, he has a Pluto-Sun opposition, which the astrologer tells me is the hallmark of a born revolutionary.
Mm-hmm. So the psychologists tell me, so is birth order. Mm. What's his birth order?
His birth order was last.
Aha.
So
that directly coincides with a theory developed some years ago by a psychologist whose name I'm blocking on right now, who says firstborns tend to be very conventional and high achievement. Lastborns tend to be revolutionaries.
Well, there you go. I've heard that too, and I can't remember the psychologist's name either.
All the same, somehow he came to an understanding of what ultimately has become the established truth. I think it will remain established that the sun is stationary, at least in relation to the planets that revolve around it. But we've learned a great deal more since then. He is indeed a fascinating figure.
He is so fascinating because his idea was so difficult to communicate at that time. And not only for reasons of common sense and fear of religious backlash, but the whole system of natural philosophy was predicated on the Earth's being fundamentally different from anything in the heavens. And he had to fight that prejudice as well.
But he's fascinating as well for the details of his life, which we get from this fine new book of yours, A More Perfect Heaven. Is the title. Subtitle, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos. And we'll come back to his cosmology shortly. But the life as lived and all the detail that you've got on it is quite fascinating as well. It's in a sector of Poland up there. I don't know, is it still in Poland or is it now?
It's Poland still,
it is Poland.
Yes.
For a while it would have belonged to East Prussia, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
It's an area called Varnia. He was the canon of the Varnia Cathedral.
Yes.
The life within that sector of the Catholic Church, the life within that bishopric,
yes,
it turns out to be wonderfully lifelike. There's real concerns there about what you lease out the land for, how you regulate the price of a loaf of bread. At one point, he's in charge of setting the price of a loaf of bread.
Yes.
And what goes on among the many canons of a given bishopric and how they live, including the fact that many, if not most of them, lived connubially.
Yes. There were at least three, including Copernicus, who had female housekeepers who were probably concubines as well. And one of the canons had children with his housekeeper. So they were certainly having more than a housekeeper-master relationship.
And the last bishop he worked with, Danziger, is that?
Dantiscus.
Dantiscus, we Latinize
meaning
it.
That he came from
he
Danzig.
Came from Danzig.
Yeah.
Dantiscus, before he took orders, but was already an official within the church, also managed a few illegitimate children.
As did Copernicus's uncle, had an illegitimate son who became a mayor of one of the towns.
As did, now the one remembers it, many popes.
Many popes, yes.
It was somehow
it was a different time.
A more swinging church in those days than it is now.
Well, one wonders. It's still pretty swinging.
Yes, but these days it swings only AC but not DC.
Right, right.
Which is a little disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
But what? That is judgmental, and one should never be judgmental on matters concerning sexual preference these days.
That's right.
Where did his knowledge come from? What's his history as a student?
He has a great pedigree as a student. He attended the Jagiellonian University in Krakow, and that seems to be where he got interested in astronomy. There are books that he kept from that period that still survive, his texts. And he assisted an astronomer in Bologna when he lived there as a law student.
I want to go directly on with this, but it's time to pause. I'm
a little
late for some commercials already, so over-involved am I in this conversation. But I can't resist this. Can you think of one other eminent Catholic who's a graduate of Jagiellonian University?
No.
John Paul II.
Of course. Of course.
And directly back to Dava Sobel, drawing from our new book, A More Perfect Heaven.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to Dava Sobel. We're drawing from this fine new book, which I predict will be as large a bestseller as your great work on longitude, A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos, just published by Walker. Well, we're just beginning to talk about his education.
Yes. So he studied the typical course of arts studies at the Jagiellonian University, but then he was sent to Bologna to study canon law, church law, and then he went for a second round of graduate school in Italy to become a medical doctor so he could be the bishop's personal physician. So he attended medical school in Padua.
His role in the church, and he really finally did not take holy orders, did he?
No. He was not a priest.
He was never able to do the Mass because
right.
he was not
right.
fully enpriested, if such a word there be.
Yes, ordained.
Ordained.
enpriested.
Is the established word. But what was the nature of that status? Is it a kind of a position which still persists?
His status was really as an officer of the church
yeah.
and an administrator. And the work he did is really not done anymore. For example, he, for a period of years, had charge of all the farmlands to the south of the diocese and actually had to be there and oversee the exchange of land parcels, the collecting of rents for the peasants. The peasants would pay a nominal fee per year for the privilege of working the land, most of which bounty they had to give back to the church.
They were essentially sharecroppers,
yes,
in our term.
Yes. And yet they had the right to sell their parcel or deed it to their descendants. And Copernicus had to oversee all of those transactions and record them. And his ledger of these transactions survives. And it's so interesting to see how he treated people differently depending on their status. So if an elderly couple had no children to help them, he cut them a lot of slack.
He was an administrator.
Yes.
For a church, for a cathedral, which in fact also owned a large portion of the area.
It did.
It was a landholding operation.
Owned thousands of acres.
As they no longer are.
Right. And he got a handsome income.
And he established a household with a long-term housekeeper who was, in fact, quite clearly his connubial companion.
The bishop certainly thought so and was agitating strongly for her to go away.
Mm-hmm. How long was she with him, in fact?
It's not clear.
She is Anna.
Yes.
That's her real name.
Yes. There was a real female housekeeper named Anna Schilling. He may have had more than one housekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
The records of his life are woefully thin. Compared to Galileo, who left about 1,000 letters to his fellow scientists, there are only 17 letters from Copernicus.
And we also have a few other written and ultimately published works that precede his great work on the revolution of the spheres.
Yes.
The first one is really an anticipation of that great work.
Yes. The first is a sketch, an outline of
just
the
20
idea.
20 pages or so.
Yes. And he sent that to, it's not known how many people, but it was probably sent as a letter laying out his idea and saying that he was at work on a big book in which he would explain all the mathematics explain all the mathematics and give the theory its full due. And then there was a great silence.
Now, this idea that the universe is geocentric rather than geocentric, this didn't pop whole into his head out of nowhere. There are some anticipations of this in earlier work, are there not?
There are, but he didn't know about it. Aristarchus in the 3rd century BC had intuited the same thing. What would happen if the Earth were in motion? Wouldn't it be easier to explain the daily revolution of the stars
mm-hmm.
by having the Earth turn? And wouldn't it be better to say that the planets don't keep changing directions? they seem to do that because the Earth catches up with them and passes them on an inside track. So Aristarchus figured all of that out and also realized that if that were true, it would mean the stars would have to be much farther away than people generally assumed. But Aristarchus's book on that subject disappeared in antiquity. Another book he wrote survived, and it's a book Copernicus read and was familiar with. But it wasn't till the year after Copernicus died that the heliocentric idea from antiquity got translated and published in Latin. If he had known about it, he would have said so, because he needed the authority of antiquity to present this preposterous notion.
There he is sitting around in this provincial Polish-German town. He has friends. He has contacts. Does he share these thoughts with anybody while he's developing them?
He had a friend in the cathedral, a fellow canon, who was his closest friend and shared his interest in astronomy. And later, when the big book gets published, Copernicus thanks this man for having encouraged him.
And he is and by name?
His name is Tiedemann Giese.
Yeah. He shows up a lot
in
your
book.
Yes, in
the book, yes.
And Giese must have encouraged him.
He must have encouraged him. He was also a very tolerant man. And because of the Protestant Reformation and the actual conversion of many priests and bishops in that region to the Lutheran faith, the last remaining Catholics were holding on. And Copernicus's bishop had banished all the Lutherans from his town. But when Giese was made bishop of the neighboring diocese, he took a different attitude. He really felt that we were all Christians and shouldn't worry about these differences.
As you mentioned, the Lutherans, that brings in a very important figure in the story, a young Lutheran student, deeply interested in astronomy, becomes a professor at the University of Wittenberg, where he got his advanced training as early as his age of 22.
Mm-hmm.
And Wittenberg, of course, is the university at which another rather better-known faculty member was Martin Luther.
Martin Luther, indeed. And it's this young man who learns about Copernicus's ideas and undertakes a dangerous 500-mile journey all the way to northern Poland to find him and study with him and push him to publish the book.
He beats a path to his door.
Exactly.
And of course, he, that is to say, Copernicus, has been holding back on publication.
Yes.
And he knows that this will offend the church and might get him into serious trouble.
He fears it will offend not really the church, but he fears that people will use chapter and verse twisted to their purposes to malign him. And he fears ridicule because the idea seems so crazy. And he also felt that he didn't quite have enough information. There were certain observations he was trying to make of the planets at certain points in their orbits that he couldn't get. And Rheticus brought him some information that he needed.
Yeah. And may even have assisted in the composition of some of the chapters of the book.
It's clear that he did.
That's what you say.
Yes.
It's so interesting to note that somebody who essentially held the same belief and was strongly influenced by Copernicus and pronounced these ideas publicly some years later got in very serious trouble with the church and was threatened, in fact, with excommunication.
That was Galileo.
None other than Galileo.
Yes. And when Galileo made his discoveries and saw that they gave evidence for Copernicus's ideas, he began speaking publicly about them. And not only speaking publicly, but speaking in Italian and writing in Italian, so that these ideas were available to people who couldn't afford a university education. And that got the church very worried, and that's why Galileo was temporarily silenced, and Copernicus's book wound up on the Index of Prohibited Books.
Interesting to remember that Galileo is required by the Inquisition to repent.
Yes.
He goes through a public repentance ceremony in which he disavows his own thoughts and his own writing. And then we have that famous scene, probably apocryphal, in which odd as these, he murmurs. You remember what the line is?
But still it moves.
Pur
si muove.
Si muove. But it still moves.
And he probably did say that, but not at the end of the trial.
Yeah.
it's almost certain that he actually said it during his lifetime, because there's a painting of him that was done during his time that has that motto in just painted into the painting. Yeah. Probably when he left Siena after the period following his trial, when he was finally allowed
to. How many years was it before the simple truth about the way in which the solar system works, as laid out by Copernicus, was generally acknowledged by people of some intelligence?
Generally acknowledged. Certainly by the 18th century. It took a long time.
When did the church yield on this?
Well, they yielded in stages. So within the 18th century, they began allowing books that treated of the Earth's movement to be published. But Copernicus's book and Galileo's dialogue remained on the index till 1835. It's stunning to think.
That's what, 250 or 300 years?
200 years, yeah.
Only two, a mere yeah. 200.
A mere 200 yeah. years, from 1616. Galileo's dialogue went on later because it didn't get published till the 1632.
We're about to pause for an update on the evening's news, and then directly back. And we've talked about Galileo, we've talked about Reticus a little bit, we've talked, of course, a great deal about Copernicus, even about his companion Anna Schiller. We haven't talked much about you.
Okay.
And we'll do that as we continue to weave together their life stories and their achievements with yours after we pause for the evening's news.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
We return to conversation with Dava Sobel, who is the author most recently of the book that we're discussing tonight, A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos. Literate people listening will remember that she is the author of Longitude and Galileo's Daughter. Longitude... or do you say longitude?
Depends which side of the ocean you're on, really. I say longitude.
Yeah, but the Brits do say longitude.
They do.
Yeah, and there are little touches of Anglophilia that persist and corrupt my American speech. It was a tremendous success around the world, wasn't
I'll never get over the surprise of it.
This 18 was or 20 story? Languages?
Oh, more than 30 languages.
More than 30.
Yeah.
What was the most obscure language it was translated into?
I think Icelandic.
Uh-huh.
That was my favorite. And it's now going to be published in Russian, which hadn't happened before.
And so. Somebody made a television feature
of
it?
Yes, there was a Nova program that was a docudrama.
Yeah.
And then there was a made-for-television movie with Jeremy Irons.
Ah, my goodness.
Yes, goodness, how did that happen?
How do you account for this?
I think people saw the story as making the world more interesting. Here was this topic that seemed dry as could be, background, boring lines on maps and globes. But it actually had a deep story full of life and death, trauma and drama. And it made you think that maybe everything had a story.
I guess about all innovation does. Mm-hmm. Have a story.
Yeah.
And if one doesn't know the story, you invent one. For years, I believed...
This one I didn't invent.
No, I'm sure you didn't. You have a lot of documentation to work with. For years, I believed the story that the lowly earmuff was invented by Lester Crawford, who was the mayor of Cooperstown, New York, in the year 1848. The connection being that that's where, supposedly, Abner Doubleday invented baseball, and the first... baseball season, or the first set of baseball games, was at Cooperstown, and they loved the game so much they played into midwinter, and it was hard on the ears of the players.
Yes.
Therefore, Lester Crawford invented the earbuff to keep their ears warm.
Except but it's not true.
Totally untrue. Totally untrue. Lester Abner Doubleday did not invent baseball. That's now very, very clear. Lester Crawford was not the mayor of Cooperstown, though he may have lived there, I don't know. And the earmuff has a totally different history. But one can't take longitude, as you have tracked its origins and its development, and in any way disconfirm
No, no. No, longitude has a fascinating man-bites-dog kind of history because the solution to the problem came from someone who was self-educated, unheard of, and had a different idea from the rest of the European academic establishment, who were all trying to find an answer through astronomy. And he thought he could build a clock that would work at sea. His name was John Harrison.
We haven't even mentioned that.
No.
Copernicus, of course, was credited with Copernican cosmology.
Now we credit him.
Well, he was even in his after
well,
his
he
immediate
died
time,
as soon
he?
As his book appeared, so I don't think he ever heard a term like Copernican.
But no one else ever claimed the credit.
No. No. And he continued to be discredited for a while.
Yeah.
But certainly by the early 1600s, he had a major supporter in Kepler.
Yes.
And then Galileo.
There's a great name. We've mentioned Galileo. We have not yet mentioned Johannes Kepler. Say a word about him.
Yes. Kepler thought that Copernicus was definitely on to something. And in his early correspondence with Galileo, he urged him to come forward in support of Copernicus. But it wasn't until Galileo made his great discoveries that he felt he had something he wanted to say out loud.
Let's say something about you. You are a Brooklyn girl. You're a Bronx girl.
I'm from Brooklyn.
Boy.
Right.
Yes.
I grew up right near the Bronx Zoo and the Bronx Botanical Gardens and went to the Bronx High School of Science.
Did you ever know Alvira Paul?
I don't think so.
No, of course not. But I courted her. She lived in the Bronx.
You know that long subway ride?
I remember, yes.
Yes. And did you come out on the elevated?
Elevated underground. It was a long, long
journey. It was a long
journey.
Trip.
Yeah. But I knew her at Brooklyn College, but she lived in the Bronx. And that's where
we went.
She went
to Brooklyn College every day.
She went to Brooklyn College, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
People were very...
You didn't go to...
For a while, I was at City College.
At City College.
In Manhattan.
In northern Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And then... You were...
I was, also at Antioch College for a while.
Antioch of all places.
And the State University of New York at Binghamton.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in everything and couldn't figure out what to major in.
Did you do science of some sort?
I did. I was in biochemistry for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I also took Italian for no good reason at the time. But I could not have written Galileo's Daughter without that. So
you kept your Italian alive, did you?
I kept it alive, and I discovered, I actually went back to school when I started working on that book, but I discovered something wonderful, which is that the things you learn when you're young stay with you, and if you just have to poke at them a little bit and they bloom again, whereas the things I learned 10 years ago are just gone forever.
Well, that is true about language, of course. Mm-hmm. Language acquisition is possible within
the
first 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, it's a very different...
It's much different.
A very different matter. My first language was Yiddish.
Uh-huh.
And I hadn't used it for 50 years, I suppose. But then I started reading Yiddish again and found it a whole wonderful world. And
yes.
I keep looking for Yiddish speakers. There are, of course, clubs and organizations where... dedicated to the revival and the maintenance of that language. But what accounts for your undertaking this general, entering into this general genre of writing? It's all about science.
Yes.
About the human side of science.
Yes. And I've been interested in science since I was a child.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was a chemist. My father was a medical doctor. So I had a lot of science around me.
Well, you went to Bronx Science.
I went to Bronx Science.
Which is a high school.
Yes, that's a high school. But even in grade school, I was tracked into a science specialization class. And not long ago, I found a report card from the fourth grade.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember how teachers used to write out long comments?
Yeah.
And the comment said that I was very interested in the subject of life on other planets.
Uh-huh.
So even then... And a big influence on me was Carl Sagan. I was living and working in Ithaca,
uh-huh.
and I went to a public lecture that he gave before he was famous. And it really changed my life because...
No kidding.
Although I'd been interested in science, I had never really focused on astronomy. And from that night forward, that became the thing I read most about.
And did you get then to spend time with Carl?
Yes, I did. I was asked by a local newspaper to write a profile of him, and he agreed to let me interview him. And then he liked my piece. So when I applied to Cornell University to be the science writer in the news bureau, he wrote me a recommendation and I got the job.
How interesting. So you were on at the news bureau of Cornell University for some number of years.
Yes, and then I got to have fairly frequent contact with him.
Well, he's an old friend of mine.
Really?
He was.
He was, yeah. It's such a loss.
A terrible loss.
Terrible.
And in fact, I was with him in the last year of his life. This is about you, not about me, but I can't resist telling you, even though we're on the air,
that
the last public prize he received was given by me.
Oh.
It was in Seattle. It was for the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, of which both he and I were board members, and they were having their annual meeting in Seattle where Carl
was
in treatment for his special brand of blood cancer at the University of Washington. And we gave him, of course, gave him the first Isaac Asimov Award. Asimov had left some money for I was asked to kind of work up the oration and present the prize, which I did.
Oh,
the last
wonderful.
Time I saw, he had been on this program many times before.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
He was such a wonderful speaker.
Incredible man. As a matter of fact, if you want to hear him again, he's a podcast of one of the broadcasts we did with him is on our website.
I've heard him again the most recently.
There must be podcasts all over the place.
He's everywhere. Yeah. I was at a science conference in Spain, and I met the Spanish Carl Sagan, the one who did the voiceovers for Cosmos in Spain. But they also played the original. And I was just instantly in tears.
Well, one interest you shared with Carl Sagan, obviously, you've said so already, is an interest in extraterrestrial life.
Yes.
And there's much more that's happened in the world of astronomy and cosmology than, there's more in cosmology than even Copernicus dreamed of.
Far more.
And we might talk about some of that in relation to the world that opened with Copernicus when we return after we pause for this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And returning to Davos Sobel, A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos, is the title of her new book, published by Walker and Company. So you and Carl Sagan both were interested in extraterrestrial life. How pleased he would be that since his death, we've discovered literally hundreds of planets, some of them Earth-like planets, circling yet other suns, some of them even in our own galaxy.
The first time I heard him speak, he was talking about the possibility of discovering planets of other stars. Mm-hmm. And I remember he drew various diagrams of what those solar systems might look like. Mm-hmm. Of course, now that we've found them, they don't look like prediction, but that's what's so exciting about science.
Copernicus didn't know about galaxies.
No.
As a matter of fact, in his time, it was understood there was a solar system, and he reorganized how
even
we think
the term
about the solar
system didn't exist then.
No, but he knew there were planets, and there was the sun. But all that other stuff that one saw in the sky, what did he make of it? Did he just think it was gaseous clouds, as was assumed for hundreds of years after that?
Well, what he could see were really stars.
Yeah.
He wasn't noticing nebulae.
What did he know about? What did he think of
the
those stars?
The stars were thought to be on a sphere. Everything was in celestial spheres.
Yeah.
Of course, he uses a few words in his book, so people have been arguing for centuries over whether he actually thought the planets were embedded in hard spheres or that they just moved in spherical patterns. But the stars seem to all be the same distance away because we see them year after year in their same configurations.
Mm-hmm.
Some are brighter than others, but they don't really change much. Only when there's a nova.
But they were all the same distance away. What idea would he have had as to the extent of that distance?
Well, he changed the distance because he realized if the Earth travels around the sun, he didn't know what that distance would be, but it was millions. He knew it had to be many millions of miles. And you would think that you would notice a difference in the stars as you moved over such a broad expanse of space, that the stars would look closer together sometimes or farther apart, but they never do. And even that realization wouldn't throw him off the scent. He said, well, it just means that they're so much farther away that the distance between the Earth and the sun is really no more than a point in comparison.
Mm-hmm. So he began to have some sense of the vastness.
Yes. Yes. And I use that a lot in my play because it was one of the more difficult ideas he had to convince people of.
But wouldn't he be delighted to know just a quick summation of contemporary knowledge about the extent of all the real stuff out there?
He would love it.
That there are.
Yeah.
That ours is just one galaxy of 100 billion or more galaxies in the knowable universe, and that the average galaxy has about 100 billion separate stars.
Yes. And furthermore, that all the galaxies, everything we can see visually, is now considered only a tiny fraction of what the universe actually contains.
It's not all there is. And wouldn't he have an interesting time contemplating the notion? It's still a notion, but entertained by many, as you know, physicists and cosmologists, that ours may be only one of an infinity of other universes.
That's a thought.
It's quite a thought.
That's a thought to give him pause.
Let's return to your book, because we've made mention of the play within the book, but we haven't said anything about it. It's an excellently wrought play.
Thank you.
And it came before the rest of the book.
Yes. Well, the play was the original idea, was to consider what these two men said to each other. Here they were, different ages, different religions. They had everything going against them. Probably Copernicus had to hide Rheticus because his presence was illegal in the diocese. So what went on? How did Rheticus convince him?
And convinced that Rheticus in reality did convince Copernicus to ultimately release his full work?
Yes, I don't think anyone doubts that, because it was Rheticus who took a copy of the manuscript to Nuremberg, made the arrangement with the printer, who was someone he knew, and actually oversaw the printing and proofreading for a period of months. Yeah, no one doubts that Rheticus. In fact, there was a slogan, no Rheticus, no Copernicus.
Really? What basic arguments did he use to convince the very reluctant Copernicus?
Well, that's just it. Nobody knows. No one tape recorded their conversations.
As you imagine it.
As I imagine it, when Rheticus arrives, he doesn't really think that Copernicus means to restructure the cosmos. He thinks he's about to learn a new mathematics that will provide better results for predictions of planetary positions. And once there, he discovers that Copernicus sees this as reality. And so he becomes frightened and disoriented, thinks he's found a lunatic recluse. And eventually they work it out.
With great hesitation on Copernicus's part.
Yes, yes, which is also a matter of record, that he hesitated mightily. And I had fun creating a machine that Copernicus allows Rheticus to try that gives him the sense of the Earth's motion.
Yeah. Yeah, this stuff about machines, it turns out that he did some observations, not with telescopes.
Not with telescopes, but he did observations. He had instruments that helped him gauge the distances between celestial bodies.
And you describe those machines. You even have an illustration from that time, I guess.
Yes, and in fact, there are models of them
even now.
One is called a triquetrum, and it looks like a couple of sticks hinged together. And one of the sticks has little sighting vanes, so you line them up and look through them at a particular object, and because you have to move the stick up or down, it will tell you how many degrees above the horizon your object is placed.
Astrology did not fully handicap us from learning about the nature of the universe. In some sense, it assisted, even though we got beyond astrology.
Yes, astrologers were interested in the planets. Yeah. In fact, why else would you do astronomy at that period, except to know the positions of the planets so you could cast a horoscope? Galileo was the first who showed a way to understand what the planets were made of.
Yeah. You've recovered some wonderful documentation. There are many letters, as well as quotations, from his works and other works in the book. But one that I found particularly fascinating was from a Cardinal Nicholas Schoenberg, who was within the Vatican.
Yes.
And explain that and read that letter, if you would.
Cardinal Schoenberg knew of Copernicus's work and was interested in helping him publish. This was another person who urged him to publish, but he didn't follow the cardinal's advice. Did you want me to read the letter? Yes. On November 1st, 1536, the cardinal wrote from Rome, "Some years ago, word reached me concerning your proficiency, of which everybody constantly spoke. At that time, I began to have a very high regard for you, and also to congratulate our contemporaries among whom you enjoyed such great prestige. For I had learned that you had not merely mastered the discoveries of the ancient astronomers uncommonly well, but had also formulated a new cosmology. In it, you maintain that the earth moves, that the sun occupies the lowest and thus the central place in the universe, that the eighth heaven remains perpetually motionless and fixed, and that the earth, together with the elements included in its sphere and the moon, situated between the heavens of Mars and Venus, revolves around the sun in the period of a year. I have also learned that you have written an exposition of this whole system of astronomy, and have computed the planetary motions, and set them down in tables to the greatest admiration of all. Therefore, with the utmost earnestness, I entreat you, most learned sir, unless I inconvenience you, to communicate this discovery of yours to scholars, together with the tables and whatever else you have that is relevant to this subject. Moreover, I have instructed Theodoric of Redon to have everything copied in your quarters at my expense and dispatched to me. If you gratify my desire in this matter, you will see that you are dealing with a man who is zealous for your reputation and eager to do justice to so fine a talent. Farewell."
Is that a letter that Redicus carried with him too?
No. This reached Copernicus before Redicus arrived.
Oh, before Redicus.
Before he arrived. And Copernicus saved this letter and later had it published in the front matter of his book.
As a way of justifying to the church.
Yes, another protection.
The work itself.
That and the work was dedicated to the Pope, as I mentioned.
Yeah. Fascinating figure. As yours has been a fascinating career, and you're still having fun with it.
I'm having a wonderful time, thank you, especially here with you.
Well, thank you. But what... where have your intellectual travels taken you now?
Now I'm interested in a group of women who worked at the Harvard College Observatory in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and they were hired to do the mathematical work. They were human computers. They were not allowed to touch the telescope.
Yes, I've run across a reference to them. Sometimes.
Yes, a lot of people know about them. And they were considered, women were thought to be more careful than men with this kind of detail work, and also cheaper to hire, which was certainly true. And then? they went on to do great things.
We have come to the end of the available time. It's a wonderful new book, A More Perfect Heaven. If you enjoyed any of the prior work of Nava Sobel, you will certainly enjoy this one. It's brilliantly written, and the narrative is fascinating, as is that historical period. The A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos, is published by Walker Books. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.